Visualize currents of light being set up by this circular motion. See them grow brighter and brighter and take on colors. Repeat to yourself as a litany or mantra the words, "The rings and the rays swing into being." Imagine yourself standing poised on the globe of Earth with arms lifted in invocation as it swings in its orbit through space. There is a famous picture by G.F. Watts that can serve as a model, reproductions of which can be obtained for a few pence. The colored plates in astronomy books also help the realization. Out of all these, build up a mental picture of the beginnings of evolution and imagine yourself as part of it, swinging through space with the movement of the cosmic tides. Remember that you, actually, were part of it, though in an unevolved state, and that the experiences then undergone remain deep in your subconscious memory, and that they will be aroused by the reconstructing of the picture images. The result of this work will be to put you in touch with primordial causation. Having obtained a clear mental picture by means of the foregoing exercise, remind yourself that these forces still operate on the highest levels of the inner planes, and it is their perfect rhythm and balance which determines that harmony of all the levels of manifestation, like the flywheel of a vast machine. Think of this enormous swirl and rhythm as carrying with it, like leaves on a stream, the nations and their affairs, so that, however much they may swirl in eddies among themselves, the main current is all the time bearing them away to the great ocean of being. The purpose of this exercise is to prepare a basis for the realization that all things are parts of a single whole, which is the being of God. It is the first stage in the work, and the foundation must be well and thoroughly laid by clear realization before the next stage can be commenced. But at the same time the relation of the part to the whole must be borne in mind. The 28th of November 1939 in London the go ahead is given for the seizure of German goods on the high seas. Much of the teaching in the previous letter is based upon the principles in Dion Fortune's work The Cosmic Doctrine, mediumistically received at the commencement of her founding the Community of the Inner Light in 1923-4. This was used as an advanced study text for members of the society, although not publicly published until after the war. This grounding of the work in hand with abstract spiritual principles is put into effect with the meditation subject for this period, the realization of the rings and the rays swinging into being. In her eighth letter she recapitulates the method and rationale of occult working and its relation to mysticism, and brings the focus of attention down from the root principles of the equilibrium of the cosmos as figured in the rings and the rays to specific contact with the unseen helpers behind the group and the nation, the work for the week being to realize the comradeship of the elder brethren. Letter number 8, for November 28, 1939. It is this combination of the mental with the spiritual, or the spiritual with the mental, according to the degree of knowledge possessed by those who do it, that constitutes the difference between occultism and mysticism. We are engaged on the mental aspect of the work, those who come to us in the light are engaged on the spiritual aspect of it, neither would be effectual without the other, but together we can almost literally move mountains. It is in this manner that over and over again the souls of nations have been influenced by invisible guidance. What we are doing is nothing new in the history of the mystery tradition, but it has never before been explicitly stated save to those who have taken the oath of the mysteries, that it can be revealed in these letters is due to the fact that a new epoch has commenced. We are not so foolish or fantastic as to claim that our work as a meditation group is controlling the fate of nations, but we do claim, and not without evidence in support of the claim, that we are sharing in activities which are exercising a definite influence in world affairs. Those who have co-operated with us thus far cannot fail to be aware that something beyond the human mind is at work. Now comes the time when we begin to put our faith to the test. The feeling that we are not isolated individuals but part of a disciplined army, gives us a sense of confidence in the effectiveness of what we are doing, which is half the battle in inner plane working. We especially need this week to gain a realization of the work that is being done by those whom we call the elder brethren, those who come to us in the light, and of whom we have already, in varying degrees, had experience. Their presence should become increasingly real and tangible to us. They are indeed real personalities and their presence is an actual fact, even though the form under which we perceive them is an image in the imagination. It corresponds to reality, and is used to form the psychic link. Its use will be found to be effectual. To those who have not yet achieved a realization, or who have not got as clear a realization as they could wish, I would say, act as if what I state were true, take it as a working hypothesis and give it the benefit of the doubt, and you will soon feel the sense of reality that comes when those on the inner planes get in touch. It is our faith that enables them to get in touch with us in the first place, but once the contact is made, faith soon hardens with a certainty of experience. The 3rd of December 1939 this week conscription is extended to include all men of 19 to 41 years of age. A certain amount of stress and unbalanced force was beginning to be felt by many of those engaged in the work, and in the 9th letter Dion Fortune describes how to cope with this kind of problem, which occurs whenever powerful contacts are being effectively made. In this same letter she goes on to make an interesting observation about mediumship and its place in the armamentarium of occult techniques. Much of her own best work was obtained by this means, and although it is a modus operandi that is easily abused, she felt strongly that there was a place for it, properly used in the context of an occult group. Part of this was as a kind of power contact, at quarterly meetings of the group when most members were present, even the most junior, when a trance address would be made. Apart from the verbal content of the communication on these occasions, she regarded them as an important means of inner contact for those not yet capable of making their own conscious inner contacts very readily. Nonetheless, this did not obscure the important point that no one should be reliant on another's mediumship, the idea being to be one's own medium, and in these unusual times the opportunity for this was great. Letter number 9. For December 3, 1939. Because we are, by reason of the work we are doing in this group, in close touch with the soul of the race, we shall be able to experience its stresses and to find them reflected in our affairs, stirring into activity whatever latent sources of trouble may be lying dormant. These personal problems can be dealt with in meditation in just the same way as the work for the nation has been done. It will be found a great help, in this respect, to visualize the presence of the master with whom one feels the greatest affinity, and to conduct with him an imaginary conversation in which we tell our troubles and imagine the answer being given to us. These imaginary conversations, colloquies, as they are called by mystics, enable us to get in touch with the masters, and even if we are not sufficiently developed psychically to hear the reply, we get an extraordinary sense of peace and support from the contact. If we perform this meditation practice last thing at night, we will frequently find that when we awake in the morning the situation has clarified, for that which was heard by the subconscious mind only, has worked through into consciousness during sleep, so that although we may not hear directly the voice of the master, we get the message quite clearly. This method or working is well understood by mystics as well as occultists, and it will be seen that it entirely eliminates the necessity to employ a medium. The initiates have always maintained that one should be one's own medium, and this is how it is done. Because we are getting in touch so closely with the group mind of the race, we shall find ourselves increasingly liable as individuals to be affected by its ups and downs, but as fellow workers with the elder brethren we have the right to ask for help and advice if we feel we need them. I would urge all our friends and fellow workers to avail themselves of this opportunity to establish contacts with the masters, for it does not often happen that the veil is as thin as it is at the moment. The power and tangibility of the response that comes through will astonish those who are new to this method of working. We are fully entitled to help and protection in any difficulties or stresses we are exposed to through our participation in the masters' work, and this help is unfailingly forthcoming if it is invoked. I would again urge my readers to take advantage of what may be a unique opportunity of obtaining very valuable first-hand experience of the invisible realities. In spite of attacks made by M. Blavatsky and others of her school of mediumship, initiates of the Western tradition do not decry its use under the right conditions, it is indiscriminate use that they deplore. Mediumship is made use of in the occult schools in the same way as an amplifier is made use of in a lecture hall. It is employed when a master wants to speak to a number of people at the same time. The initiate, however, is always taught to be very careful not to come to depend on such broadcasting to the neglect of his own development. A good psychic can often pick up the message that is coming through a medium a sentence or two ahead of the spoken word, that is to say, if the message is a genuine one. The value of a message obtained through mediumship as used by initiates does not depend only on what is said, which may be no more than a few words of blessing, but upon the very powerful psychic atmosphere that is generated by the master who is projecting the message. All these things are part of the training and work of the mysteries, so it is necessary that those who participate in this work should have an understanding of this. Headline, Text to Picture. The 28th of January 1940, this week in Spain, the Council of Ministers outlaws Freemasonry. In Poland, Jews are forbidden to travel by train. The letters that follow contain general theoretic points that are readily accessible in published work, in response to various questions that had apparently been put to Dion Fortune by less experienced participants in this series of workings. When the 15th letter was issued, the inner tide that runs between the winter solstice and the vernal equinox was in full spate. The meditation work for the week had been to invoke the purifying tides of destruction upon whatever is obsolete, selfish and inefficient in our country. And Dion Fortune duly reports the results. Furthermore, towards the end of this letter we have a new development in the work, in the invocation of angelic protectors for the country. Letter number 15, for January 28th, 1940. On Sunday, in the sanctuary, we meditated on the tides of destruction, fearlessly invoking their purifying force. This is a bold thing to do at any time, and particularly so when working with an untrained group, but the results entirely justified the experiment. The outline of the astral images was peculiarly steady and solid, and the power came down in the symbolic form of a great jet of steel, grey water behind which, in the center of the circle, appeared the red, robed master of the Ray of Jebera. There was a tremendous sense of strength under control, of steadiness, of a complete grip on the forces that were being brought through. At the end of the meditation, when the banishing pentagrams had returned all to normal, there was a profound sense of peace and protection that was remarked on by all present. We must hold firmly before the soul of the race a bracing, a stringent ideal, not relaxing our watch or laying down our weapons till the word is given. A premature and unsound peace would be disastrous. Our increasing confidence lays us open to subtle influencing, against which we must guard. In order to guard against any such subtle influencing, let us meditate upon angelic presences, red, robed and armed, patrolling the length and breadth of our land. Visualize a map of Great Britain, and picture these great presences moving as a vast shadowy form along the coasts, and backwards and forwards from north to south and east to west, keeping watch and ward so that nothing alien can move unobserved. Headline, Text to Picture. The 4th of February 1948 HMS Sphinx, a mine, sweeper, sinks after being bombed by German planes. The importance of the angelic work is immediately taken up in the letter following, together with an interesting note about the preparatory work for these letters. Finland, it might be noted, according to teaching by Rudolf Steiner and his followers on the folk angels of the nations, has a special place in Europe as custodian of very pure and early spiritual contacts, partly revealed in their folk epic the Kalevala. Letter number 16, for February 4, 1940. The work of the formulation of the angelic presences is so valuable that it might well be continued, in addition to the usual weekly meditations, for the duration. It is interesting to note that at the time this meditation instruction was being prepared, such presences were reported in the papers as having been seen in Finland. Now these letters are prepared after screening the astral conditions prevailing in this country and in Germany, in addition to which, definite instructions are received from the elder brethren from time to time, but not every week. It was in obedience to such special instructions that the meditation work on the angelic presences was sent out. The fact that such presences were perceived at the same time in Finland seems to show that similar instructions were received there. It is obvious, therefore, that they are receiving on the same psychic wave length that we are, and is probable that the future will see a close union between Finland and this country. Headline, text to picture. The 11th of February 1940, paper supplies are cut by 40% as rationing is introduced. In Birmingham, 51 Ra bombs explode. The 17th letter sees the beginning of a developing symbol complex that is to play an important role in the work to come. One of the hallmarks of truly contacted occult work is the way that symbol systems will build organically and reveal a sequence of development when later reviewed analytically. Starting as a simple triangle of colored light, Dion Fortune gives some basic elucidation by reference to the Tree of Life. Letter number 17, for February 11, 1940. During the meditation in the sanctuary last Sunday, a symbol of great interest and importance formulated in the course of the vision of the cave. Those who come to meet with us in the light had taken up their usual position at the foot of the cross, forming with us a circle, and the influences of the incoming life tide were invoked under the symbol of down, pouring light. The light appeared at first as the dim gray dawn light. This soon became flecked with many colors like a fioropal. Then it clarified into three definite rays, forming the three angles of a triangle with the white light of the spirit pouring down within it. These three rays were the red, the blue and the purple, and there is an important significance in the color symbolism, especially as the vision formulated spontaneously, and the significance of the symbolism was not realized immediately. The red ray is the dynamic, destructive ray of Mars, issuing from the Sephira Gebra, with which we have been working recently. Those who are familiar with the Tree of Life will remember that Gebra, or Severity, stands opposite Jejula, Chst, Mercy, from which issues the blue ray of Jupiter, and that these two are represented in symbolism as the two kings. The one, Gebra, robed in red, is armed and mailed, riding in a chariot, the sword of justice in his hand. The other, Jejula, robed in blue, sits upon a throne, the scepter of wisdom in his hand, and he is the king in time of peace, just as the Lord of Jebaru is the king in time of war. The one represents the dynamic forces of a nation, military and judicial, for we get the same scarlet in the robes of the judges as in the soldier's uniform. The other represents the organizing, socializing, civic forces of national life, the royal blue of the king as law, giver and administrator, shepherding his people. The Master Jesus is said to be the Lord of the Purple Ray. Those who are familiar with the Tree of Life will remember that Typhareth is the Christ sent to where all forces are brought into equilibrium, but in Yezud, whose color is purple, the personality aspect of the Christ force is reflected downwards into manifestation. Moreover, Yezud is called the receptacle of forces and its proper symbol is the cup, or Graal, which is the antithesis in equilibrium of the sword, Excalibur. When the time comes for reconstruction, we shall have occasion to work with the Graal forces and the Excalibur forces in balanced equilibrium, and the cup and the sword and scepter make a wonderful symbol of balanced and functional force. This triple, rayed triangle is unquestionably a very important symbol for us, and it should be in future formulated in all meditations in a horizontal position above the rose cross in the cave. The 18th of February 1940 the Polish Air Force is allowed to reform on French soil. In Munich, Hitler says, "We cannot be defeated either economically or militarily." The group had been set to concentrate upon the triangle described in the previous letter, and the following, 18th, letter is full of interesting technical detail as the basic geometrical imagery crystallizes into three key symbols, of rod, sword and cup. Letter number 18, for February 18, 1940. When we build up the symbol of the three rays of the triangle in our group meditation on Sunday, certain very striking and illuminating things occurred, things, that is to say, that have much significance when there is the knowledge to interpret them. At the commencement the meditation lacked power. Now to the experienced worker, an operation that goes wrong is just as instructive as one that goes right, in fact even more so. We had to ask ourselves why it was that a symbol that had been full of power the previous week should lack power 7 days later. The answer was not far to seek on the light of experience. The previous week the vision of the three rays had not been built up by the action of either leader or group, but had appeared spontaneously. What was described had not been formulated but was being reported as it took form of its own undirected accord. It must, therefore, have been projected down the planes by those with whom we are co-operating, and therefore, being ensealed with spiritual force, possessed a singular vividness. When we, however, following the usual technique, proceeded to build up the form in our imaginations, it lacked this ensouling force, and therefore appeared dim and dead, and there was no power in the room. But experience was again our guide, and we persevered with the uphill task, and presently power began to come in. It did not come in the shape of a brightening of the rays into the vividness with which we had seen them the previous week, but shadowy forms began to appear where the rays touched the plane of earth. Immediately this occurred, power came through. From this experience a useful lesson is to be learned, that mind, work without thought, forms is very little use. These forms were not so much presences as simulacra, that is to say, one had no sense of personality in regard to them and they appeared like line drawings within the colored rays. It is not easy to say exactly what they were, but it is to be presumed that they were projected by the same entities who had previously projected the rays. We may learn more about them later. The form in the red ray was that of the mailed and armed king with a crown upon his helm, the traditional form of Jebera, save that in this instance he was not seated in his war chariot but mounted upon a charger, thus representing an exceedingly dynamic form of the energy of the fifth Sephira. He appeared, however, to be turned partly away from us, so that we saw him from the side and rear. This signifies that the destructive force is not directed towards us, but is acting defensively by attacking. There, form in the blue ray was the traditional one of the king seated on his throne. The form in the purple ray was that of the Master Jesus in his aspect as the risen Christ, clad in a seamless robe. Then, these pictures having formulated, for they were definitely pictures and not personalities, a symbol began to stand out clearly in connection with each of them. In the red ray it was the sword grasped in the hand of the mailed rider, in the blue ray, it was the scepter held in the hand of the seated figure, in the purple ray, it was a cup carried by our Lord, the cup of the Graal. Those who have experience in these matters know that it is in this form that the higher communications are made. If what is to be communicated comes from a plane beyond human consciousness, words cannot be used as a means of communication, a symbol appears, and if we meditate upon it, realization gradually dawns. It also acts as a link or means of communication with those who sent it, for meditating thus is exactly like dialing a number on the telephone, it puts us in touch with that which the symbol represents. It is, in fact, exactly as if someone were to give you his telephone number so that you could put through a call whenever you wanted to. Usually, in esoteric work, these key calls are kept very secret, but as this one was given openly, it is evidently meant to be passed on openly, and I am therefore giving it so that all who wish to do so may use it. On the other hand, these key calls can be made use of by persons who might wish to break up what we are doing. I think, however, that the entities at the other end of the line are very well able to take care of themselves. The forces with which we work are not innocuous, and we may as well face the fact that they can blast as well as bless. It would not be well to call up that number in the wrong spirit. It now remains for us to find out the significance of the three symbols taken together, thus forming a glyph, which is a composite symbol. They represent a formula, the formula with which it may be presumed we are to work. Let us consider them individually. The sword of Jebera, the sphere of Mars, means the dynamic force destroying evil, it is Excalibur, the sword of chivalry. The scepter is the rod of power whereby the invisible forces are ruled and directed. Being in the hands of the seated king of the Sephirot Stor Jejula, the sphere of the planet Jupiter, it means that the knowledge which directs these forces is to be applied to the governance of the race. The cup is a symbol of many significances. It is associated with Isis as the moon, cup, the symbol of womanhood, and with Christ as the Graal, the receptacle of spiritual influences. The receptive aspect, of course, links it also with womanhood. These three symbols, conjoined, represent a formula which it is our task to work with and work out. The 25th of February 1940, American envoy, Sumner Wells, arrives in Rome to start talks for European peace. In her 19th letter, Dionne Fortune gives some guidance on the significance of one of the three symbols, the rod of power, and goes on to make some astute observations, based on experience, of the nature and significance of esoteric work, even by a few dedicated and trained souls. She is also in no doubt about the occult powers being deliberately invoked by the forces of Hitler's Third Reich. As I have described in The Magical World of the Inklings, Element Books, 1990. The occult nature of these forces were also characterized in their true colors by C.S. Lewis' science fiction novel That Hideous Strength. In matter-of-fact terms described by Dionne Fortune, we see the actuality of some of the behind-the-scenes activity in the war between these forces of darkness and light. Letter number 19, for February, 25th, 1940. The symbol we will consider this week is that of the figure seen in the Blu-ray, the king upon his throne with the scepter, the rod of power in his hand. This symbolism belongs to the Sephirot, also called Jejula, or mercy in equilibrium with Jebera or severity. It is the sphere of Jupiter, as Jebera is the sphere of Mars, and represents Jupiter well aspected in all its benign majesty and dignity. It is the sign of the king in peace, directing and governing his people, and its distinguishing symbol is the scepter. Now this scepter is the rod of power and signifies occult knowledge directing the astral forces. This teaches us that the knowledge of the secret wisdom is going to play an important part in what has to be done for the winning of the war and the building of a stable peace. This may sound fantastic, but it is only necessary to read the unexpurgated edition of Mein Kampf to see that the Nazis are fully alive to this. And that, the manipulation of the racial subconscious mind is one of the strongest cards they play. This card can only be trumped by a higher card of the same denomination. Military force is ineffectual against it, and it is here that our specialized knowledge can be of very real use. I had not read Mein Kampf at the time when I started these meditations, but now that I have read it, I can see plainly to what end they are directed, and why it is urgently necessary that they should be carried on. It may be a very small handful of leaven that we are providing, but the nature of the spiritual force employed is such that it is capable of leavening the whole mass of racial subconsciousness and immunizing it from Nazi poison. Let us meditate this week upon the tremendous forces wielded by means of the rod of power. They are far greater than we realize at present. Esoteric tradition has always averred that certain work in connection with the spiritual advancement of mankind is carried out by small groups of trained and dedicated persons set here and there among the nations, working unknown and in secret, and there is no intrinsic reason why we should not be one of them. For many years prior to the war, the fraternity of the Inner Light has so believed and taught. All that is necessary for this purpose is a nucleus of six or more sincerely dedicated persons gathered round one who has the necessary knowledge. If tradition is to be believed, we shall make a mistake if we underestimate the powers that are working through us. We may have little enough that is spectacular to show, but the work we set out to do is obviously getting done. Nor is it being done in any random manner, but step by step, in the precise order which we have been instructed to do it. It is only necessary to read over the whole series of meditation instructions in conjunction with a week-by-week record of the war to see the correlation. Bearing in mind that we were told at the commencement that this would be so, we can see that the traditional rod of power, the diamond scepter, still exercises its invisible influence, and by the methods that have always been credited to it. Still the war is being confined to the inner planes. And the amazing rise in the morale of the nation indicates the way in which the fight is going. A blitzkrieg today would have a very different effect on us to what it would have had last autumn. With every week that passes, the spiritual tide is rising, and an energy and confidence is showing itself to which this country has been a stranger many a long day. England has always had confidence in itself and distrusted its leadership. Lions led by donkeys, is the traditional axiom, but today it is beginning to feel that it has a leadership that it can trust.